This is Audible.
Some years ago, I did a production of The Importance of Being Oscar in the West End. It's a play by Michael McLeamore for one actor, about Oscar Wilde, of course. And it's an extraordinarily interesting piece. It invents a new genre, which I call living biography. That's to say that a narrator, a storyteller, tells the life of a great writer through the medium of his characters and narrates the events of his life as they reflect them autobiographically. I'd enjoyed it so much that I looked for another subject to apply the same method to. And the only qualification is that the writer's life should be as interesting as his work. And curious enough, there aren't that many people who qualify. Dickens preeminently does. I'd already played Charles Dickens, as it were, on the television when I did something called An Audience with Charles Dickens, where I recreated Dickens's public readings. And I'd had various engagements with Dickens over the years. I'd done A Christmas Carol in Rep, and I'd also played Mr. Micawber on the television about 15 years ago. But this was a different venture. It's not really about playing Charles Dickens. It's about talking to the audience, telling the audience, involving the audience in the events, the drama of a man's life, but without ever really pretending to be him. Though I hope that the impression left on the listener and the member of audience in the theatre is that somehow they have spent time with Charles Dickens. So in a funny kind of way, it's a sort of a conjuring trick. He is evoked, his characters are evoked, but there's never really any pretense that there's anyone other than me telling the story. In the theatre, I don't change costume, for example. I don't wear any makeup. I'm just my usual stocky, bearded self, becoming alternately Miss Havisham, Pip, Mr. Micawber, indeed 49 other characters, and various characters from Dickens' own life, his father, himself as a young man, himself as a middle-aged man, himself as a prematurely old man. I play also various friends, Wilkie Collins, etc. In other words, I can sort of light quickly on these characters, and then they're gone, they're wiped, and then we're on to the next character, or back to just me talking to the audience. And what's wonderful about this technique is that I really am communicating directly with the audience. I had become very frustrated as an actor for some time before in various quite respectable productions that I'd done in various places like the National Theatre and so on, with the sense that I wasn't really connecting with the audience. They were watching. They were, on the whole, quite respectful. They were there because they felt they should be there, but I didn't really feel that they were there, as it were, in the minute, actually listening. Well, of course, if you're talking directly to an audience, as I was, it's infinitely and immediately more engaging. As it were, they can't quite avoid my eye. It's a sort of Ancient Mariner effect. The first question, of course, at my having decided I wanted to do a play about Dickens was who should write it. And actually, there was no hesitation at all on my part. Peter Ackroyd was so obviously the right person to do it. I knew him a tiny bit, and I knew that he was very interested in the theatre and that he had indeed wanted to write a play, though he hadn't written one. But, of course, he was the author of the definitive modern biography of Dickens. And so I got in touch with him and sent him a copy of McLeamore's play, The Importance of Being Oscar, and he was enchanted by the idea, so I got somebody to commission him, and he wrote the play in about 10 minutes, it seemed. And, of course, it wasn't exactly right straight off. So we sat down with various bottles of extremely good red wine and thrashed it out. And then he went away and came back a week later and wrote another version. And then 4 days after that, he wrote a third version. And then 2 days after that, and then the last one came almost by return of post. And that was the version that we started rehearsals with. We didn't rehearse for very long at all. We rehearsed for 2 weeks. We rehearsed the first act in the first week, and then I learned it that following weekend. We rehearsed the second act in the second week, and I learned that. And then we did the first performance, well, only about 2.5 weeks after we'd start rehearsing. Not with set, not with light, not with costume, but with just an audience and me in Belfast. Then we did 2 more performances in Wilton's Music Hall. Both were more or less charity performances, but it meant that I'd got the hang of it. I'd found out how the audience relates to it. And the relationship with the audience is the all-important thing. This play has changed and changed and changed, and it's always changed because of what the audience has taught me about it. If I'm boring them, if I don't really hold them, if I make the narrative muddy in any way, if they don't quite believe in the characters, if they don't find what's being said funny or shocking or whatever, then it's wrong and I must change it. And that's a wonderful advantage that a one-person play has over even a play with two or three people in it. Because Peter Aykroyd and Patrick Garland, the director, and I are very close friends, and we work together very, very easily. We can change things almost at a moment's notice. Literally, for the first 6 months of doing the show, I don't think I did the same text any one day. It's sort of settled down a bit now. We're about to take it on a world tour, but I dare say that'll change again, because American audiences will be very different to Australian audiences and so on. It's had a kind of wonderful impact on the audience. I say that without any undue modesty, because it's an inarguable thing. I'm not talking about good reviews. I'm talking about what people feel when they're in the theatre. And the quality of attention in an age in which people are supposedly unable to concentrate on anything for any length of time and require constant diversion and, you know, tap girls and copulating scenery and I don't know what else, they didn't get it in this show at all. They just had this one man standing on stage talking for 2.25 hours, and I never found any audience which wasn't up for that. It's been the most exhilarating experience. I think people partly have been astonished at how little they know about Dickens himself. The most English-speaking people have some sense of the books. Even if they haven't read them, they've seen an adaptation or whatever. But his life was really extraordinary and very much fed into his works. And I believe that there's been a sort of odd and an interesting reaction from the audience, in the sense that people feel rather, almost you might say, proud that the human race is capable of throwing up such a remarkable and interesting and positive person as Charles Dickens. He was not without his flaws, God knows, but in an age of extreme scepticism and indifference towards the possibility of fundamentally changing the human condition, Dickens actually spoke fearlessly and unforgettably about issues such as justice and poverty and human decency, and people still very much want to hear that voice. The Mystery of Charles Dickens by Peter Aykroyd, performed by Simon Callow.
Does no other profession occur to you, Nickleby, which a young man of your figure and address could take up easily and see the world to advantage in?
No, Mr. Cromwells, sighed Nicholas, shaking his head.
Why, then, I'll tell you one. The stage! The stage, cried Nicholas. The theatrical profession. I am in the theatrical profession myself. My wife is in the theatrical profession. My children are in the theatrical profession. I had a dog, lived and died in it from a puppy.
Say but the word, and I'll bring you out.
I want a novelty.
Charles Dickens once wrote that the more real the man, the more genuine the actor. That may or may not be so. It's an open question. Certainly he was writing of himself, though, and he declared, "I was an actor and a speaker from a baby." His father, John Dickens, used to take him to the public house, set him up upon a table where he would sing and dance to the wonder of the assembly. He did impersonations of various local eccentrics. He was an irrepressible entertainer, an infant phenomenon. "I must have been a horrible little nuisance," he said. At the drop of a hat, he would recite from his favourite poem.
"Did the voice of the sluggard, I hear him complain? You have waked me too soon, I must slumber again."
He had a toy theatre, too, in which he played with characters Penny Plain and Tuppence Coloured. Some say he was playing with them for the rest of his life. In Chatham, in Kent, where he grew up, he was remembered as an active, alert, eager, odd child. Hysterical, perhaps. Oversensitive, certainly, but decidedly odd. "I looked at nothing that I know of,
but I saw everything. And now I see the outside of our house, with the latticed bedroom windows standing open to let in the sweet-smelling air, and the ragged old rooks' nests still dangling in the elm trees at the bottom of the front garden, where the fruit clusters on the trees, richer and riper than fruit has ever been since in any other garden. A great wind rises, and the summer is gone in an instant. We are playing in the winter twilight, dancing about the parlour, when my mother's out of breath and rests herself in an elbow chair. I watch her winding her bright curls round her fingers and straightening her waist. And nobody knows better than I do. She likes to look so well, and is proud of being so pretty. "My dear boy," cries my mother, caressing me. "My own dear little boy." These idyllic childhood days were without any doubt the happiest days of Charles Dickens's entire life. And suddenly he was snatched away from all that happiness. His father, who worked in an office of the Admiralty, was transferred to London, and at the age of 10, Charles Dickens was on his way to the city which changed him forever. London. But not Victorian London, much less modern London, a more intimate, a more compact, a more colourful city, a city of street criers and strolling peddlers, of cockfights and public hangings, of pleasure gardens and of small, unlicensed theatres. There was no uniformity or system to it whatever, so it encouraged eccentricity and oddity of every kind. It would in time become the city of Dickens's vision, of his imagination. But for the 10-year-old boy, there seemed nothing ahead for him at all. His father was spending quite recklessly, and his mother's attempts to found a school, Mrs. Dickens's establishment, she grandly called it, foundered when she failed to enroll a single student. The family's fortunes were in rapid decline. They'd moved into a small house in Camden Town, the view of dingy poverty, his purpose in life making himself useful, polishing his father's boots. Education gone. Company none. Happy and secure life? Gone forever. The idyll and innocence of childhood disappeared altogether. I fell into a state of dire neglect, which I have never been able to look back upon without a kind of agony. I don't know how the household furniture came to be sold for the family benefit, or who sold it, except that I did not. A sale was held at Gower Street North, however, and my own little bed was so superciliously looked upon by a power unknown to me, hazily called the trade, that a brass coal scuttle, a roasting jack, and a birdcage were obliged to be put in to make a lot of it, and then it went for a song. So I heard mentioned, and I wondered what song. I thought what a dismal song it must have been to sing. His father was getting further and further into debt, and they were subject to constant humiliations. The child remembered everything.
"Oi! You ain't out yet, you know! Pay us, will ya? Don't I, you know, that's mean. I wouldn't be mean if I was you!"
But they did hide. They kept moving from house to house. And then, just 2 days after his 12th birthday, Charles Dickens was set to work in a blacking warehouse beside the Thames. It's no exaggeration whatever to say that his childhood died in that dismal place. It was a crazy, tumble-down old house, abutting, of course, on the river, and literally overrun with rats. Its wainscoted rooms and its rotten floors and staircase, with the old grey rats swarming down in the cellars, and the sound of their squeaking and scuffling coming up the stairs at all times. And the dirt and decay of the place rise up visibly before me, as if I were there again. The blacking was for shoes. His job was to cover the pots of paste blacking, first with a piece of oil paper and then with a piece of blue paper, to tie them round with a string and then to clip the paper, close and neat, all around. When he'd finished a few gross of these, he was to paste on each a printed label. He worked a 10-hour day, with one meal break at 12, and a tea break in the late afternoon. A few days after he'd entered the blacking warehouse, his father John, insolvent, ruined, was confined within the Marshalsea prison for debtors. When my father said, "The sun has set on my life forever," I really believe that these words had broken my heart. Dickens took those same words and wove them into the fabric of his art when he directly introduced them into his novel David Copperfield. Were they the expression of his father, John Dickens, or of his invented character, Mr. Micawber? Who can tell? Perhaps there's no difference. On the first Sunday after he was taken to the prison, I was to go and see Mr. Micawber and have dinner with him there. He was waiting for me within the gate, and we went up to his room, top story but one, and cried very much. Then, after many tears, he told me this.
"Annual income, £20, Copperfield. Expenditure, £19, 19 shillings and sixpence. Result, happiness. Annual income, £20, expenditure, £20, aught and six. Result, misery. The blossom is blighted, the leaf is withered, the god of day goes down on the dreary scene, and, well, in short, you're forever flawed, as I am."
After which he borrowed a shilling of me for porter, gave me a written order on Mrs. Micawber for the amount, and put away his pocket handkerchief and cheered up. Not so easy for the 12-year-old Charles Dickens to cheer up. There was even worse to come for him, fiercely proud as he was, even at that early age. The blacking factory moved to a main thoroughfare in Covent Garden, and he had to sit and work in a window where he could be stared at by those who chose to stare at him. His mother and brothers and sisters, by now five in number, joined John Dickens and the Marshalsea. But the 12-year-old Charles was placed in a lodging beside the prison. I kept a small loaf and a quarter of a pound of cheese on a particular shelf of a particular cupboard to make myself supper when I came back at night. No advice, no counsel, no encouragement, no consolation, no support from anyone that I can call to mind. So help me God. Each night, returning through the darkened streets from the blacking factory, he was filled with anxiety and terror. But he said nothing about it at the time. Not to anyone. He laid it within his breast, where it grew and grew into a vision of the world. At the time, he just did his work. And to his little working companions, he told stories, or lies, rather, about his childhood and about his family. In fact, Dickens never really stopped lying all his life. It was the source and secret of his existence, just as it would become the salvation of his art. I knew I was common, and I wished I was not common. And the lies came out of that somehow.
"Let me see you play cards with this boy," said Miss Havisham. "With this boy?" said Estella with disdain. "Why, he's a common labouring boy. He calls knaves jacks, does this boy. And what coarse hands he has. And what thick boots."
I had never thought of being ashamed of my hands before. But I began to consider them a most indifferent pair. Her contempt for me was so strong that it became infectious. And I caught it. He was a common boy in a commonplace world. I was such a child and so little that frequently when I went into the bar of a strange public house for a glass of ale or porter to moisten what I'd had for dinner, they were afraid to give it to me. I remember one hot evening I went into a public house and said to the landlord, "What is your very best ale? A glass." For it was a special occasion. I don't know what it may have been my 13th birthday.
"Tuppence halfpenny," said the landlord, "is the price of the genuine stunning ale."
"Then," says I, giving him the money, "just draw me a glass of the genuine stunning, if you please, with a good head to it." The landlord looked at me over the bar from head to foot with a strange smile on his face. His wife came out from behind with her work in her hand and joined him in surveying me. They served me with the ale, though I suspect it was not the genuine stunning. And the landlord's wife, opening the little half-door of the bar and bending down, gave me my money back, and gave me a kiss that was half admiring and half compassionate. At night, the boy read his old books, reading as if for life, as he said. Tom Jones, Peregrine Pickle, Roderick Random, Don Quixote, Robinson Crusoe. They all kept me company. They kept alive my fancy and hope of something beyond that time and place. There were times, though, when he simply could not bear it. He doubted whether he could ever be clean again. One day in the blacking factory, he fell into a fit, which lasted all afternoon. But then, as if he were a child in a fairy tale, or a novel of his own making, the horrors of Charles Dickens's early years were suddenly and abruptly lifted. His father came into an inheritance and left the Marshalsea. Then he took his son out of the blacking factory. Home for good and all. Home for ever and ever. He was sent to school along the Hampstead Road. School was not a very good one, but he wasn't there for very long. At the age of 15, he became a lawyer's clerk, and he plunged himself into London life. "His knowledge of London was wonderful," said his employer, "for he could describe the position of every shop in any of the West End streets." A colleague recalled that Dickens could imitate, in a manner that I've never heard equalled, the low population of the streets of London in all their varieties. He was still that irrepressible entertainer, you see. What he really wanted most of all at this early time was to be an actor. To go on stage. All his life he loved the company and the conversation of players. He always attended the latest productions, but more than that, he acted, directed, managed and wrote plays all his life. At the height of his fame, one of the stagehands confided in him, "We in the profession, Mr. Dickens, always thought it was a crying shame when you took up writing books." As for his clothes, they were loud and vividly coloured, almost theatrical, one might say, and those who encountered him in public places noted that he tended to strike up dramatic attitudes. It was almost as if he didn't know the difference between the stage and the street. But, of course, the street was his stage. It was his theatre. He walked the city incessantly. He didn't talk to many people, but he observed them all. And then, at about the age of 17, he started to write it down. He misses nothing. At Seven Dials, for instance, in Covent Garden, he sees a little crowd which is collected round a couple of old ladies who, having imbibed the contents of various bottles of gin and bitters in the course of the morning, have at length differed on some point of domestic arrangement and are on the eve of settling the quarrel satisfactorily by an appeal to blows.
"Why don't you punch her, Sarah?"
exclaims one half-dressed matron by way of encouragement.
"Why don't you? What's the matter?"
inquires another old woman who's just bustled up to the spot.
"Matter? Matter? Here's poor dear Mrs. Sullivan, has five blessed children of her own, can't go out a-charring for one afternoon, but what hussies must be a-coming and tossing away her own husband as she'd be married to 12 year come next Easter Monday, for I seen the certificate when I was a-drinking a cup of tea with her only last Wednesday. Mrs. Sullivan, I says, promiscuously? Mrs. Sullivan, what you mean by hussies?"
interrupted Champion of the other party, who has evinced a strong inclination throughout to get up a branch fight on her own account.
"What you mean by hussies? Never you mind," replies the opposition expressively.
Never mind. You go home, and when you're quite sober, mend your stockings.
He knew from the start, you see, that there was something greater within himself, beyond all the high-spirited mimicry and the ventriloquial gifts. He started writing feverishly. He wrote stories, he wrote essays, he wrote sketches. I could write anything. At the age of 23, he was approached by a publisher, William Hall, who asked him if he'd care to write a series of sketches upon the adventures of some Cockney sportsmen. This was still the period, you see, in which Londoners travelled to rural areas in order to make fools of themselves. He set to work immediately, but he needed a name. He always needed a name before he could begin. Then he remembered the coaches along the Bath to London Road. The name of the proprietor, emblazoned in bright yellow letters on a maroon background, was Moses Pickwick. That was it. Pickwick. The Pickwick Papers. Heads! Heads! Take care of your heads! Cried the loquacious stranger, Jingle by name, as the coach came out under the low archway which in those days formed the entrance to the coachyard. Terrible place. Dangerous. Other day, five children, mother, tall lady, eating sandwiches, forgot the arch, crash, knock, children look round, mother's head off, sandwich in hand, no mouth to put it in. Head of a family off. Shocking, shocking. Sportsman, sir, he said, abruptly turning to Mr. Winkle. A little, sir, replied that gentleman. Fine pursuit, sir, fine pursuit. Dogs, sir? Not just now, said Mr. Winkle. Ah, you should keep dogs. Fine animals, sagacious creatures. Dog of my own once, yes. Pointer. Surprising instinct. Out shooting, one day. Entering enclosure, dog stopped. Whistled. Whistled again. No go. Stock still. Called him. Ponto! Ponto! Wouldn't move. Dog transfixed. Staring at a board. Looked up. Saw inscription. Gamekeeper has orders to shoot all dogs found in this enclosure. Wouldn't pass it. Wonderful dog. Valuable dog, that. Very. Singular circumstance, that, said Mr. Pickwick. Will you allow me to make a note of it?
Silencing coat,
announced the entrance of the judge.
He was most particularly short, and so fat, he seemed all face and whiskers. He rolled in on his two little turned legs, and having bobbed to the bar, bobbed to him, and put his little legs underneath his table, his little three-cornered hat upon it.
Call Nathaniel Winkle.
Here, sir.
And now, sir, when you will his lordship and the jury know what your name is, will you?
Winkle. Have you any Christian name, sir?
Nathaniel, sir.
Daniel. Any other name?
Nathaniel. Sir, my lord. I mean...
Nathaniel Daniel? Or Daniel Nathaniel?
No, my lord. Not Daniel at all, just Nathaniel.
Well, what did you tell me your name was Daniel for, then, sir?
I didn't, my lord.
Yes, you did, sir. How could I have got Daniel on my notes unless you told me so, sir?
Mr. Winkle has a very short memory, you know, chimp. Call Samuel Weller.
What's your name, sir?
Samuel Weller, my lord.
Can you spell that with a V or a W?
Well, that depends on the taste and fancy of the speller, my lord. I never had occasion to spell it more than once or twice in my life, but I spells it with a W.
Could we continue with a cross-examination, if you please?
Of course, my lord. Mr. Weller, you were in the passage, and yet you saw nothing of what was going forward. Have you a pair of eyes, Mr. Weller?
Well, yes, I have got a pair of eyes, and that's just it. If I was a pair of patent double million magnifying gas microscopes, a extra power,
Perhaps I might be able to see through two flights of stairs and a deal door. Being only eyes, you see, my vision's limited.
The Pickwickians made the whole world laugh. Within a year, the complete novel was published in France, in Germany, in Italy, in America, in Australia. It even made its way as far as Russia. In the Pickwick Papers, Dickens created a vision of the world. He did it by bringing to life a tradition of Englishness which had never previously been captured. It was quite a new thing, a modern novel serialised in monthly parts, so that the readers were almost literally hanging on to the end of each episode. It began with a sale of 4,000 copies per month, and in the end was selling 40,000. There were Pickwick hats, Pickwick coats, Pickwick cigars. Led by the young Charles Dickens, Samuel Pickwick and the Pickwickians joined the immortals. He was 25 years old. And his fame was known all over the world. It was all before me. I was so overcharged with delight and with gusto and with anticipation and, oh dear, I almost forgot to mention my wife. He had married Catherine Hogarth just after completing the first instalment of the Pickwick Papers. He'd met her, in a sense, professionally. She was the daughter of an editor for whom the young Dickens had composed a series of urban sketches. The marriage was, you might say, the next piece of business. Please note that Charles Dickens's relationships with females were always decidedly odd. He was either in a mad and hopeless passion with them, frantic and desolate in turn, or he placed them on an impossibly high pedestal, or he was entirely matter-of-fact, not to say brusque, with them. Was he not good enough for them? Or were they not good enough for him? The question was always unresolved. Catherine was 20 when they married. A pretty little woman, plump and fresh-coloured, a genial, smiling sort of a countenance, very sweet-natured. He loved her ardently, passionately. Now, Catherine had a younger sister, Mary, 16 at the time of the marriage, and Dickens was almost equally attached to her. When the newlywed couple moved into what Dickens called a frightfully first-class family mansion with awful responsibilities in Doughty Street in Holborn, Mary moved in with them too, and a very happy little family they were, the three of them. Then, one evening, not more than a year after the marriage, in the spring of 1837, they went, the three of them, Charles and Catherine and Mary, to see a farce which Dickens had written. It was called Is She His Wife? On their return to Doughty Street, later that night, Mary retired to her room, but before she could undress herself, she gave a piercing cry and collapsed. She died of heart failure the following day, 17 years old. Thank God, Dickens wrote, that she died in my arms. And the very last words she whispered were of me. He cut off a lock of her hair and kept it in a special case. He took a ring from her finger and placed it on one of his own. This ring he wore for the rest of his life. He gathered her clothes and put them in a particular cupboard. 2 years later, he was still taking them out and looking at them. He expressed the wish eventually to be buried beside her. On her tombstone, he wrote, young, beautiful, and good. And for the rest of his life, he said, ever after, he was pursued by a vague, unhappy loss or want of something. After the briefest respite for his grief, he flung himself back into his work. Yes, work! We must close up the ranks and move on. Who is hit? Nelson called out when one of his captains was shot on deck. We are all hit, one way or another. We are all hurt in action. Yet it must be fought out like all the rest of life. The battle of life. One of Dickens's favourite phrases. In his next novel, Oliver Twist, Dickens strikes, for the first time in his own work, the note of primal terror. of a child's helplessness in the adult world. With a slice of bread in his hand and the little brown cloth parish cap on his head, Oliver was then led away from the wretched home where one kind word or look had never lighted the gloom of his infant years. And yet he burst into an agony of childish grief as the cottage gate closed after him. Wretched as were the little companions in misery he was leaving behind, they were the only friends he had ever known. And a sense of his loneliness in the great wide world sank into the child's heart for the first time.
"No, sir! No!"
sobbed Oliver, clinging to Mr. Bumble's hand.
"No, sir! No! I will be good! Indeed, I will, sir. I am a very little boy, sir, and it is so, so..."
"So, what?"
"So lonely, sir. So very lonely."
Now, this is the extraordinary thing. Dickens was writing Oliver Twist and the Pickwick Papers at exactly the same time. Comedy and melodrama, farce and sentiment side by side. He called it streaky bacon. This is what really delighted him, within the bounds of one book, even one chapter, to go from a scene of sorrow and suffering to one of wild humour and grotesque high spirits. His energy in life was prodigious, almost frightening. Light and motion flashed from every part of him. Those who knew him described the quickness, keenness and practical power, the eager, restless, energetic outlook on each several feature. Mrs. Carlyle said that it was as if his face was made of steel. Leigh Hunt observed that it has the life and soul in it of 50 human beings. He was all contradictions and contrasts, nothing grey or middling. With strangers, he was as merry and bright as you like, but with his own family, he was reserved and taciturn. With sad or shy or ailing people, he was the kindest, most sympathetic creature on the face of the earth, but with his friends, he was impatient and domineering. He could be bubbling over with laughter one moment, and then just a second later, his eyes would flash like danger lamps.
He loved the children in his books, but he did not seem to love his own children as they grew older. He worshipped food and drink in his fiction, but in life he ate little and drank less. Some say he was only truly happy when he was alone in his study, writing. But he wasn't alone. His characters surrounded him in crowds. They talked to him, he said, and they touched him.
In truth, what happened is that he became them. He spoke their words out loud. As he was writing, he would go to the mirror and put on their faces just as he put on their voices.
"Look here, Nickleby, what do you think of this poster? First appearance of the unrivalled Miss Petowker of the Theatre Royal, Drury Lane."
"Dear me, I know that lady, Mr. Crummles."
"Then you are acquainted, Nickleby, with as much talent as was ever compressed into one young person's body. It is talent of a certain sort. The blood drinker."
"The blood drinker?"
"The blood drinker will die with that girl, and she's the only sylph I ever saw who could stand upon one leg and play the tambourine on her other knee, like a sylph. Mrs. Crummles taught her nearly all she knows. Mrs. Crummles was the original blood drinker."
"Was she indeed?"
"Oh, yes. She was obliged to give it up, though.
Did it disagree with her?"
"Not so much with her as with her audiences. Nobody could stand it. It was too tremendous. You don't quite know what Mrs. Crummles is yet."
"Well, I figure..."
"No, you don't. You don't indeed. I don't. That's a fact. I don't think her country will till she's dead. Look at her. Mother of six children, three of them still alive, and all upon the stage. Extraordinary indeed. The very first time I saw that admirable woman, Nickleby, she was standing upon her head on the butt end of a spear, surrounded by blazing fireworks. You astonish me. She astonished me. Do come over to the sofa, Mrs. Wittitterly. You don't look yourself at all. I'm always ill after Shakespeare. I scarcely exist the next day. I find the reaction so very great after a tragedy, my lord. And then Shakespeare is such a delicious creature. What is the first class, Mr. Squeers?
The first class, Nickleby, is the English spelling and philosophy class. Where's the first boy? Where is he? Where's that boy? Where's the first boy?
Please, Mr. Squeers, sir, he's cleaning the back parlour window.
So he is, to be sure. So he is. We go upon the practical method of teaching here, Nickleby. C-L-E-A-N. Clean. Verb, active, to make bright, to scour. W-I-N, win. D-E-R, duh. Winder. A casement. Then boy knows this out of book, he goes and does it. And where's the second boy? Where is he? Where's that boy? Where's the second boy?
Please, sir, he's out weeding the garden.
Quite right, so he is. B-O-T, bot. T-I-N, tin, N-E-Y, ni. Botany. Noun, substantive, a knowledge of plants. When a boy's learned that botany means a knowledge of plants, he goes and weeds them. That's our system, Nickleby. What do you think of it?
Well, it's a very useful one, Mr. Squeers.
I believe you, Nickleby. Third boy.
Third boy? What's a horse?
A beast, sir.
Quite right. So it is.
A horse is a quadruped. And quadruped is Latin for beast.
Now you're perfect in that, boy. Go and look after my horse and rub him down well, or I'll rub you down. And as for the rest of class, let any boy speak a word without leave, and I'll take the skin off his back.
Nicholas Nickleby, as funny and theatrical a novel as any ever written, also changed the face of English education. Dickens' satire upon the school run by Wackford Squeers, Do the Boys Hall, led to the immediate closure of private schools in Yorkshire and elsewhere. In a similar spirit of outrage, Dickens had satirised the new poor laws in Oliver Twist. The newspapers had denounced him for his radical fervour. He was making a difference. He loved it.
What a thing it is to have power.
But of course his power wasn't political power, nor even social power. It was power of the imagination. Which is why he was able to convince his readers of the truth, the essential truth of his most extravagant visions. It's been said of Dickens that when the fire of one of his novels was threatening to grow dim, he would throw on a child to stoke up the flames. His children do have a most peculiar habit of dying, but this was no literary or romantic device. Dickens burned with them and felt all the agonies of the fire. After Nicholas Nickleby, he was writing The Old Curiosity Shop, and of course Little Nell had to die in the end. Yet she left him forlorn and miserable. All night I've been pursued by that child. I'm breaking my heart over this story. I'm slowly murdering the poor child. Yet it must be. All next week I shall be laid up with a broken heart. But I think it has come famously. Bring out your pocket handkerchiefs. She was dead. No sleep so beautiful and calm, so free from trace of pain, so fair to look on.
She seemed a creature fresh from the hand of God and waiting for the breath of life. Not one that had lived and suffered death. Her couch was dressed with here and there some winter berries and green leaves gathered in a spot she had been used to favour. When I die, put near me something that has loved the light and had the sky above it always. Those were her words. Now she was dead. Dear, gentle, patient, noble Nell was dead. Her little bird, a poor slight thing the pressure of a finger could have crushed, was stirring nimbly in its cage. And the strong heart of its child mistress was mute and motionless forever. But the death caused a sensation. The stern jurist, Lord Jeffreys, was found in tears after reading the scene, and Dickens's close friend, the great actor Macready, was literally prostrate with grief. The Irish patriot Daniel O'Connell threw the periodical in which it was written out of the window of his railway carriage, exclaiming, "He should not have killed her!" At a slightly later date, Oscar Wilde was less affected. It would take a heart of stone to read the death of little Nell without laughing. Now, all this while, Catherine Dickens had been creating a few children of her own, four in quick order and more to follow. They'd moved to a bigger house off the Marylebone Road, which Dickens said resembled nothing so much as a hospital ward, what with Walter crying and Katie snuffling and Charles Jr. sickening for something mysterious. He'd already sent his parents into exile, having set them up in a little cottage in Devon, but they had a way of turning up in small matters like the father forging the son's name to guarantee certain debts. How he raged against them! He wanted to get away from them all. He had dreams of extensive travelling. He was haunted by visions of America. He wanted to encounter a country as young and energetic as he was, and the Americans wanted to see him too. A few months before, they had gathered in the harbour of Boston, shouting to newly arrived passengers, "Is little Nell dead?" Now they were asking, "Is Charles Dickens alive? And is he really here?" He was followed by crowds wherever he went. He was given dinners and parties and receptions. He made speeches. He entertained 1,000 guests. And finally he met the President of the United States, who declared that he had not expected to meet so young a man, sir. But he did not meet with unmitigated approval. Far from it. He was attacked by the newspapers for his colourful clothes, flashy, his assertion of copyright, smells of the sharp rank, and for his mind, which according to the New York Herald was coarse, vulgar, impudent, and superficial. Now, Dickens was not accustomed to public criticism. He left the country in a state of great rage, taking his savage revenge on those same papers as only he could, in the pages of Martin Chuzzlewit, a book which, on its first appearance, was burnt publicly in the streets of New York. "Here's this morning's New York sewer!
Here's this morning's New York stabber! Here's the New York keyhole reporter!"
So opens Martin's journey to America. When Dickens returned from the United States, his appetite for travel had not yet been satisfied, so he whisked the whole family off on a grand European journey which lasted a full year. Naples. Dickens witnessed Mount Vesuvius in a state of eruption, its dark smoke hanging in the clear, bright skies. So what did he do?
He climbed up it, of course, at once. That very night.
He was warned of the dangers of ascending a volcano in a state of eruption, but he insisted it had to be done. He had to look into its smoking mouth. With only one guide accompanying him, he climbed the last few hundred feet as burning cinders and ash rained down upon them. Finally he reached the brink, where, triumphantly, "I look down into the flaming bowels of the earth. Then I came back again, a light in half a dozen places, burning from head to foot." This is pure Dickens. The wild Dickens blazing away just as he blazed away at his novels. I'm working myself into such a heat that I shall burst out prodigiously. Always onwards and upwards, climbing towards the fire. Mount Dickens. Eruptions at regular intervals. And not just in his work, either. His fire was increasingly turned against what he perceived to be the scandals and enormities of his own time. He was becoming the writer who spoke for an entire age. He was made editor of a great new national newspaper, the Daily News. He was chairing committees. He was making speeches on prisons, on the slums. And he'd just begun a series of Christmas books, which had a triumphant beginning with A Christmas Carol, the book in which he conjures up the thin phantoms of two miserable and ragged children, ignorance and want. This little story of Scrooge and Bob Cratchit and Tiny Tim took as much mastery over Dickens as it had over everybody else. He was somehow possessed by this story of redemption, of a man forced to face the truth about himself and change. Became a kind of modern fairy tale, and its effect was overwhelming. One employer, on reading the book, gave his employees an extra day's holiday. When Thomas Carlyle finished it, he went out and ordered himself a turkey. The spirit of Christmas, as newly defined by Charles Dickens, was everywhere. How at this triumphant moment in his career did Charles Dickens think of himself? Well, the secret is that he didn't think of himself at all. He was not in the least bit interested in self-communing, nor did he wish to dwell upon the sources of his art. Writing of Shakespeare, he said, "It is a great comfort to my way of thinking that so little is known about the poet. It is a fine mystery, and I tremble every day lest something should come out." Though Dickens could only approach himself by becoming one of his own characters, by transforming himself into a fiction. Which was why he was planning another novel, one in which he would tell his own story. First, though, as always, he had to find a name. He always had to have a name. Welbury, Mankbury, Topflower, Copperboy, Copperstone, Copperfield, Copperfield. This is Charles Dickens here, and this is David Copperfield here. They're staring at one another, face to face. Which one do you think will blink first? This book, of all his novels, his favourite, cost Dickens very dear. His friends had been concerned for him. Even while he was writing it, he'd often been giddy and nauseous. His left leg trembled beneath him, and he could not stop his hands and his arms from shaking. He felt a pain in his left side, the same pain he'd suffered as a child in the blacking factory. He suffered, too, from extreme depression of mind and a disposition to shed tears from morning to night. As to repose, for some men there is no such thing in this life. Idleness wearies me more than labour. To do nothing is exhausting. How strange it is to be never at rest, never satisfied. Sir Dickens was not only David Copperfield, he was Steerforth, too. Steerforth with his handsome head thrown back and the sea wind playing on his face as he calls out, "Ride on! Ride on, rough shot if need be, smooth shot if that will do, but ride on over all obstacles and win the race one has started in. Ride on!" The journey, Dickens said, is ever upward, and we must pursue it, or we are worthy of no place here. He was still climbing up that mountain. He rarely looked back at those who were obliged to travel with him. Catherine Dickens, after 10 years of childbearing, became very unwell, with spells of giddiness and violent headaches. She suffered, in general, from living in the immediate vicinity of Charles Dickens. In the spring of 1851, his father, John Dickens, that irrepressible reprobate, died after a terrible operation upon his bladder, without anaesthetic, in which the room was turned, in his son's words, into a slaughterhouse of blood. Only 2 weeks later, his youngest daughter, Dora, died, also quite suddenly. At the time, he was addressing the annual dinner of the General Theatrical Fund, expressing his gratitude towards those actors whom he so admired. Not just because the actor sometimes comes from scenes of affliction and misfortune, even from death itself, to play his part before us. All men must do that violence to their feelings, in passing on to the fulfilment of their duties in the great strife and fight of life. When the speech came to an end, he was taken to one side and told the terrible news. All that night, he sat by the bedside of his dead infant. But then, just like those actors he was praising, he returned to the strife and fight of life. I am quite confident I should rust, break down, and die if I spared myself. Much better to die doing. And what was he doing? He was directing and playing in a comedy by his friend Lord Bulwer Lytton. It was called Not So Bad As We Seem. Oh, Bulwer Lytton's wife said, Mr. Dickens makes a habit of acting with a dead father in one pocket and a dead baby in the other. And ever by day and night, Dickens wrote, under the sun and under the stars, move all we restless travellers through the pilgrimage of life. But somewhere, he said, somewhere in all these travels, there was a still small voice crying out within him, crying out, help! London. Michaelmas term lately over, and the Lord High Chancellor sitting in Lincoln's Inn Hall. Implacable November weather. As much mud in the streets as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth, and it would not be wonderful to meet a megalosaurus. 40 foot long or so, waddling like an elephantine lizard, up Holborn Hill. Smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle with flakes of soot in it, as big as full-grown snowflakes, gone into mourning, one might imagine, for the death of the sun. Fog. Everywhere. Fog. Up the river. Where it flows among green meadows. Fog down the river, where it rolls, defiled among the tears of shipping and the waterside pollutions of a great and dirty city. Fog on the Essex marshes. Fog on the Kentish heights. And hard by Temple Bar, in Lincoln's Inn Hall, at the very heart of the fog, sits the Lord High Chancellor in his High Court of Chancery. Never can there come fog too thick. Never can there come mud and mire too deep for this High Court of Chancery, most pestilent of hoary sinners. This day, in the sight of heaven and earth. Dickens believed himself, at the age of 45, to be growing old. There are people saying quite loudly that he's finally burnt himself out, that David Copperfield was his last flare. When Little Dorrit appeared, it was dismissed as twaddle. In some ways, the spirit of the age was, in all its high Victorian seriousness, against him. Dickens was often dismissed as a mere entertainer, a writer whose reputation would not last as long as the century. So here he is, in middle age, with his achievements apparently behind him, and what was ahead of him? Oh, only an increasingly loveless marriage and a large, ever-expectant family. And please remember, too, the great poignant note of his life, that vague, unhappy loss or want of something which has pursued him since the early death of his sister-in-law. Where again will he ever be able to find someone young, beautiful, and good? He felt that his life was slowly closing down. My blankness is inconceivable, indescribable. My misery, amazing.
As a child, Dickens had wandered the London streets of crumbling, straggling houses with its dirty men and filthy women and squalid children.
That I suffered in secret and that I suffered exquisitely, no one ever knew but I.